It's wonderful to be here. It's a great privilege. But without further ado, let's get into the panel. And we're here to discuss the singularity. It's one of the newer tropes in science fiction, and I think it's something we can easily find lots of material to talk about through the course of the panel.
So, contrarian. New going on 20 years.
Well, we're going to get to that. But I thought I'd just like... of course, being a good scientist, I went on to Wikipedia. This is what it had to tell me. So, technological singularity. This refers to the hypothesis that technological progress will become extremely fast and so make the future unpredictable. I guess that's a fairly uncontroversial statement. Well, I'd just like to ask my fellow writers just to introduce themselves, and then once we've introduced ourselves, I'm going to ask Werner to sort of recap his ideas about the singularity. So I'll begin with myself. I'm Al Reynolds, science fiction writer, former space scientist. I've written a few novels. I guess some of them have touched on sort of ideas bordering on the singularity, but I don't show up on Wikipedia. Carl.
I'm Carl Schrader. Written a few novels that are sort of far future, I guess, science fiction. I'm trying to lower my horizon from 1,000 years in the future down to something reachable like 500 right now. I'm also currently taking my master's degree in strategic foresight and innovation. And I don't know what that means either.
It's fine. I'm Charlie Stross, and I guess I've written two novels that are associated with a singularity. One called Singularity Sky, which was nothing to do with it whatsoever, except they needed a catchy title. And one called Accelerando, which was sort of my take on it, and my way of trying to avoid having a nervous breakdown while working in the development team of a successful .com in the late 1990s, when we were getting through about 1 year's worth of change every 10 weeks. Things were a bit frantic.
So you've lived through your own personal singularity as well?
Oh yeah, I'm just a burnout case now.
I'm Vernon Vinge, and I used to teach math and computer science, but I've also always written science fiction, and so that's what I've been doing exclusively since 2000.
Can everyone hear us, by the way? We're not mic'd up. Are we coming through okay at the back?
Okay. Well, back I can.
Okay, we'll project. If we start getting quieter, please do let us know. Well, I think the sort of notion of the singularity was an idea that was sort of floated by a number of thinkers from the late 50s and into the 60s, but it was Werner who really took the bull by the horns, if you like, and made it a recognisable science fictional trope. So who better than Werner to ask to give us a little précis of the singularity and what it means to us?
my take on the term the technological singularity is that I think it's likely that in the relatively near future that we will be able to, using technology, create or become creatures of superhuman intelligence, and that since intelligence and creativity is what has put us at the central place in this world, as far as we can tell, that something that was better at that than us would be a ship large enough to break the name singularity. Now, there's another aspect to it when compared to other forms of technological change that is qualitatively different. And that is, if you're talking about intelligence, then you're in a situation where, in comparison with past technologies, you could imagine, if you could talk to somebody from the 19th century, you could explain 2010 to them. You could explain our time to them. They would understand. They might not believe you, but they would understand what you were talking about in 2010. You could not undertake successfully the same experiment with a goldfish. And to me, that's what kind of gets us into the ballpark of this panel, because we here are all interested in science fiction. Many of us write science fiction. If you believe that this development is something that's hiding in our near historical future. And if you also are interested in hard science fiction, then you sort of written yourself out of a job. And so the consequences of that, I'm very interested to hear. I'm very interested to hear about, and I think I'll have my share of kibitzing too.
Well, I'll come back to you in a minute, because I'd like to hear if you sort of modified your ideas in any way over the last 20 years, whether you still think they're on track. Well, that's a question I'm going to put to the other two writers here. Do you personally believe in, if you like, the Vingian singularity? Do you think that we're headed towards that kind of cataclysmic, world-changing event in our relatively near future?
Well,
Charlie?
Point number one I'd like to make is that we're already on the other side of a singularity, one that happened at some point between 250,000 and 70,000 years ago, the development of language. You don't necessarily have to agree with Richard Dawkins' meme theory to recognize that language is a cultural medium that allows for horizontal transmission of behavior between individuals, and that without language, we wouldn't be sitting in this room now, just for starters. Language represents a singularity in terms of how the Earth's biosphere evolved prior to the development of that trait, and it's still playing out. It's far too early to tell whether linguistically enabled animals are in fact an evolutionary successful strategy. There's some evidence that we're rather unstable in that respect. Can I just put
relatively few science fiction writers that were handicapped by the development of language with it?
This is true. It's true. There's one other thing I'd like to add as well, which is, while Werner stated the case for singularity fairly cogently, there's this sort of halo of grotesque misunderstandings and what Ken MacLeod refers to as the rapture of the nerds that's sort of grown up around it. Somewhere along the way, rather than being a hard SF speculation, firstly, the idea of mind uploading, being able to digitize the neural connectionist map of your brain and run it in a computer, took on. And somehow, this has become transmuted in the popular consciousness into, we're going to develop this technology and we're all going to go flying up to machine heaven. There's a little bit of a leap there, and it has unfortunately tarred the term singularity with a brush of spurious eschatology. I'm just pulling this out of my ass.
What's your take on it, Paul?
Well, the term "take the bull by the horn, by the tail, and face the consequences" just came to mind. I'm not the kind of person to actually believe things. Werner has his sandbox, and a lot of people are playing in it, and I have my own sandbox. It's not a matter of believing it or not. As somebody who does a certain amount of technology foresight, one thing I know that you do is you never put your conceptual eggs in one basket. I mean, if your insurance company said to you, your dad died of a heart attack, so you're gonna die of a heart attack. So we're gonna cover you for a heart attack. And that's it. I don't believe we should, even if it were true, imagine only one future. And this is the main problem that I have with the idea, regardless of whether it's true or not, is that many people think that it is the future. And basically, science fiction, not about predicting the future, it's about minimizing surprise. And if you believe in one particular future, what you're really saying to me is that that is the only future that's not going to surprise you. And for that reason, I'm developing my own scenarios, and also for fun. And I'm asking questions like, what is intelligence? What is technology? What are the drivers, the hidden assumptions behind the idea that technological change drives changes in society? Coming up with very different answers.
Well, I think one of the things that kind of surprised me at times is you will write something. I might write a story that features Mind Upload or something, and then a year later or whatever, I'll see some comments on the internet that kind of treats the story as if I'm advocating it as a good thing. Whereas, that, as Carl says, we all have sandwiches to play. In fact, some of us have more than one. And one can legitimately, if you like, buy into an idea and believe it wholeheartedly for the sake of a story or a novel. But one doesn't necessarily believe it the day after. And I sort of have that sort of state of mind about singularity in a sense. And I can believe all the arguments. It's sort of like believing six impossible things before breakfast. But I can sort of take the individual arguments and I can accept that such a thing might be plausible. But I can also, I think I can construct equally compelling arguments why it might not happen. And I might want to use one set of arguments in one story and another in another. But certainly, as Charlie says, there's a whole constellation of sort of nebulous transcendental thinking that's sort of created around this concept. And as a writer, I'm not in any way interested in advocating mind uploading or you know, becoming disembodied silicon intelligences.
A great basis for founding a new religion, though, putting L. Ron Hubbard to take notes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're all getting along too well, though. I think the audience
is getting along. Let's just go back to Werner for a second. I'm going to take questions in the sort of second half of the talk, unless we say something really stupid. Bernard, have you modified your ideas in any way, or do you see the sort of the time scale differing from your initial thoughts?
I tried to avoid the relative time prediction. You know, but like AI, for at least 40 years, artificial intelligence has been 30 years away. And I think what I've been consistent on, I said I'd be surprised if it happened before 2005. I'll stand by that. and I'd be surprised if it happened after 2030. And so that, you know, I'm still in that ballpark. And it seems to me to be about as plausible as before. Very much agree with what Carl said about scenarios. It's very important to be thinking about different scenarios. I personally think the singularity scenario is the most likely non-catastrophic outcome for the next 30 years, but it's certainly not the only non-catastrophic outcome. In fact, I think a general utility of scenarios is that they give you checklists of things to watch for as you go forward in time. And as things happen or they don't happen, it alters your ratings. In some cases, actually modifies the scenarios. So making lists of what you'd expect to be seeing ongoing, if that's the path we're on or that's not the path we're on, I think, not speaking as a science fiction writer, I'm just speaking as a general person who has to live in this real world, is a good thing to do.
But when you sort of open Scientific American or whatever your sort of journal of choice is, do you sort of say, oh yes, there's that sort of neural cognition box tip?
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah. And the reverse. I mean, it's a lot of fun to watch software debacles. And the possibility of something that will be so bad that not because anybody passes a law, but just because we don't want to go there because we lost so much money, that's sort of negative. It's something that I watch for.
Yeah, there was a phrase I learned the last term in school from one of my instructors who's a business person. And that was there's no such thing as disruptive technologies, only disruptive business plans. And, you know, from her point of view, absolutely true. It's Christopher the Mill, anyway.
Charlie, do you think we're on, if you had to put it in terms of more or less probable, do you think we're on the...
My head hurts whenever I try and evaluate the probability of it. Part of the problem is the concept of artificial intelligence. To quote a famous dead computer scientist, Edgar Dijkstra, The question of whether a computer can think is no more interesting than the question of whether a submarine can swim. We might well develop soft technologies which deliver the functionality of human intelligence quite possibly far more powerfully without actually having something that you can have a conversation with, without having something that resembles a human mind. Partly, we don't really understand yet how human consciousness works. We may actually be a lot further than we think from understanding the basics of neuroanatomy. There was some research reported fairly widely the past month that really set me back on my heels when I read it. It was actually research into photosynthesis in algae, but biochemists had been trying to figure out how electron capture worked in chlorophyll, in algae, and they had confirmed actual working quantum entanglement as a mechanism for moving electrons at room temperature.
Phone Roger Penrose.
Exactly. You know, that's a worrying one, because if that one turns out to be happening in mammalian neural tissues, suddenly artificial intelligence looks a whole lot harder, because at this point you're having to use a large quantum computer rather than a classical computer to do it. If it is actually a significant event at the macro scale rather than just being lost in the noise.
But then you could really well say that that's a major cornerstone of understanding that we passed.
Yeah.
So that brings the whole thing closer.
Yeah. We don't know, though, whether consciousness is something you can model at a very high macro level and is actually quite simple and just a hack on large modules, or whether it's something that emerges from very low down. And until we know that, trying to figure out whether a singularity is likely is a bit foolhardy.
Well, also, I think we're using one word to cover many things.
Yeah.
We don't really know what intelligence is. The one thing that I find uninteresting about the idea is the idea of the exponential curve, which, if you've studied any systems theory, there's an idea from there that's the limiting factor, which is a term that we all know, but I think it comes from there. And it's basically that large interconnected systems always have one or more elements of the system that put a brake on how quickly it can evolve or grow. And you might remove that limitation and suddenly have, you know, potential for infinite growth in that one part of the system. But in real world systems, that never means that the system as a whole grows infinitely. What it means is that something else becomes the limiting factor. And so if intelligence ceased to be the limiting factor for our civilization, based on our experience with other systems, we would expect that something else would become the limiting factor, not that we would suddenly have the rapture. So the devil's in the details of figuring out how something like this would actually, this sort of transformation would actually happen. And I wasn't joking when I quoted that there's no disruptive technologies, only disruptive systems. I mean, it's very, very true. We have all the technologies we need to turn this planet into a paradise. The technology is not the limiting factor.
Well, we're sort of 20 minutes into the talk. I suppose we should steer things a little bit into the direction of, has the singularity been a good thing for science fiction writers or a bad thing? I'm going to begin with Werner again. Werner's books, particularly The Deepness of the Skyscraper Tonight, are books that sort of engage centrally with the notion of the singularity.
One thing certainly happened in my The Deepest Sky and Fire Upon the Deep, in which I think I notice in other writers of space opera, is that whether or not you as a writer believe or have any personal belief in the likelihood of something like the technological singularity, if you think that there are a significant number of people who might buy your book, who think that the singularity is likely. There is a commercial need, even if no intellectual need, to write a story that has human-sized characters, even if they're not humans, and has some sort of reason why such creatures would exist and would be doing their thing. And so in a lot of modern space opera, if you look at it carefully, you will find something in the story that indicates why the singularity either did not happen or is not relevant to the story.
Yeah, totally.
And Gilby here with perhaps one of the crudest solutions, which is just say, it can't happen here.
Right.
Walter John Williams did a particularly nice variation on this in the Praxis books, in which there is no singularity because the galactic empire run by these ancient and vastly powerful aliens kill anybody who does it.
Charlie, when you started working on the Accelerando stories, you must have had an idea that you were going to take these characters through some kind of singularity at some point.
Not while I was writing Lobsters. The idea occurred to me midway through the second story. Lobsters ended on an odd note, and I think it needed a sequel. Halfway through writing the sequel, I suddenly realized, hang on, this is what I should be doing with it. Sort of a trilogy, 9 stories in 3 groups of 3, each group dealing with a successive generation, each generation of which is almost a different subspecies from its parents. It seemed a bit megalomaniacal at the time, circa 1999, but it seems to have sort of worked. What really, if I can wibble on a bit, annoys me most is when I read reviews of Accelerando. I mean, there's one fairly prominent British reviewer who ripped into it on the grounds it had a talking cat. He missed the point. It doesn't have a talking cat. It has a vastly transcendent intelligence that has discovered that human beings can be manipulated by a sock puppet shaped like a talking cat.
Yes, I recall a bunny from someone else's mind. But gotta remember that this isn't a new issue for science fiction. In the Verda books, I was thinking more in terms of requiring a Butlerian jihad, right? The whole thing with Dune was that Herbert wanted a particular kind of civilization because he wanted to tell a particular kind of story. And he knew that having artificial intelligence back in 1963 or whatever was going to make that kind of civilization impossible. So he said, okay, I'll just ban it,
which was absolute masterstroke.
It was, yeah.
For me, one of the great things about Dune, and I'm not a particular fan of the later books, but for me, Dune is a wonderful piece of creation, is the fact that it just hasn't dated, because there's nothing in it to date. I mean, it's sort of got that quintessential weirdness. You still have the sort of Baroque technologies and the space engines, but almost any other book from that period, at some point the character will send a message packing down a pneumatic tube or use a teletype or something. There's nothing like that in Dune because of this wonderful edict against artificial intelligence.
And there's no need to justify it. Yeah. It's just a prejudice.
Yeah.
And that's it. We have nothing more to say.
Actually, I could speak a bit. On the one hand, whenever you actually get people discussing the prospects for artificial intelligence in public, in a public forum, there is a note of anxiety underlying the discussions. They want to have a handbrake. They want to have an off switch. On the other hand, I mean, I'm not sure an off switch would ever be effective if we did achieve intelligence. Eliezer Yudkowsky, who's thought about this quite a lot, came up with a very interesting variant on the Turing test. It's the AI in a box test. Let us postulate that we have a really vastly super intelligent AI, and we want to keep it under control. The idea is you've got it in this box, you're not giving it access to whatever it wants. If it can't get out, it's no threat, is it? Well, Eliezer has this bet with various friends, and what it is we set up a Turing test type scenario in which he pretends to be the vastly transcendent AI, his friend is talking to him over an instant messaging line, And he has 1 hour to convince him at some point to say, okay, I'm giving you access to such and such. Yeah? Four times out of five, he can talk them into giving him access within 1 hour.
Right.
And he is merely a very bright human being.
Yeah, you see, that whole issue makes no sense to me whatsoever. Because the solution is actually transparently simple. Intelligence is not the same as identity. And the hidden assumption in that issue is that a transcendent intelligence would have its own center of identity the way that human beings do. But if you injure a person's head in the right places, he ceases to have a sense of self. And the idea is, all you need to do is assign the AI's sense of self to you, so that it is, as far as it's concerned, you. And all the things that you want.
I tremble if you're the guy, if you're the guy who if I'm not the guy who has the power.
Yeah, well. It's a good thing that we were born now and not a little bit later, maybe. But yeah, it really has to do with more the low-level functions of cognition issues like that. I mean, computers right now are not self-actualizing. There's no reason to think that the smarter they get, that will emerge in and of itself. We have modules in the brain that were evolved to give us things like a sense of self, a sense of embodiment, senses of purpose, values, norms, all of these things. They are all structured pieces of the whole. And
you just handed me a very important piece of plot for novel, Carl.
Oh, thank you.
An AI-assisted sociopath.
Yes. Well, exactly, right? So
he wants something, stuff comes to him.
Sure, yeah. And you get to the idea of augmented intelligence, right? And something that DARPA is really interested in right now, which I'm sure you'll all find very reassuring. and that's part of what I call the artificial unconscious, where what you do is you use computers and artificial intelligence to extend yourself into the environment around you, rather than having the brain in the box model. And that's potentially takes us in a different direction. We can debate that in various novels.
Well, I mean, the point is that these ideas are sufficiently stimulating that they can set us off thinking about the stories and novels. And that's, in one sense, the singularity as a notion has been useful because it's generated whole sequences of stories and novels that we've all...
Well, and Werner's right. I mean, my Virgo books, I had to contend with the fact that I was going to get asked, why didn't the singularity happen in the universe?
But have we now reached the point where one can't necessarily conceive of the 500-year future without the singularity? Does it feel like we're missing out, we're leaving out the elephant in the room, if you like, if we don't have it happen?
I think in the sense that the idea of the singularity raised a bunch of questions that we have to deal with. It's kind of like the Unforgiven of science fiction, right? You can't make another Western without referring to Unforgiven. And you can't write science fiction set in the mid-future without reference.
As John Clute put it, in some subgenres of science fiction, you end up with deep genre. For example, it was impossible after about 1950 or 1960 to write a time travel story that didn't take as an assumption the reader's familiarity with The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, The Grandfather Paradox, All You Zombies, and a whole bunch of other stuff, which had sort of defined the field. It's sort of like packed with the devil stories. It's a bit of a hard sell these days. You've got to come up with an original twist. You can't just do it straight anymore.
But that makes it so interesting to see if you can come up with, again, alternative scenarios that are just as sophisticated. Because the singularity is very sophisticated. It rests on a whole bunch of assumptions. So when you're starting to model a different future, what you find is that you're tearing up all kinds of assumptions that you didn't even know you had, like the idea that technology has agency and can cause change in and of itself. Oh, gee, I never even thought of that, right? So once you start questioning, or once you start thinking, holy crap, I can't just do another singularity novel. I'll be part of the singularitarian movement. And you want to do something to define yourself, you go back to these basic levels and start asking questions that you never thought to ask. So
before we open
up, get accused of contrarianism.
Before we open the panel up to questions, I'd just like to put one more to Werner. What when you, if you like, convinced yourself of the imminence of the singularity, did you find that that was making it harder for you to write science fiction, or easier? Was it like a mental roadblock?
I felt that it was a mental roadblock. It relatively easy to work around because of magical assumptions such as the zones of thought or whatever. And like a lot of constraints, that by itself often makes good stuff. Actually, I have let me elaborate on it in sort of a crazy direction, and that is, suppose I seriously, you know, eat my own poison here. Going forward, instead of thinking about a science, what you're going to write next, think of what happens to you, a science fiction writer, over the next 15 or 20 years. And a year or two ago, Charlie and I think Corey were interviewed jointly for Locus. I'm not misremembering
it. It was, I think, a couple of years ago, but yes.
And I think it was you. I don't think the question was put something about this singularity is affecting you a lot. And you made, I think, a very important comment, and that is you expected that I think you said specifically, with Accelerando, you've reached the end of your singularity, you know, thing there, and it's going to go forward, but you're not claiming, you know, but you said, just wait. 15 or 20 years from now, I may actually have a lot more understanding about what's going on. And so, as time goes forward, both we and our markets may become smarter. And it's very interesting to think about what early post-human art would be. I mean, if you think that post-humans are a significant aspect of post-singularity world, think of what it must. I always go by analogies with something like this, since I don't have any other real tool. But think what it must have been like to tell the first joke. It probably was not a very good or very funny joke, but that didn't matter. And so there was this glorious period, you know, where almost anything funny you could think of saying was the original. I get the same feeling when I read old science fiction, actually. It's so bad, but that doesn't matter, because the ideas, you know, are so cool. So the role or the life of an early post-human artist or science fiction writer would be a very interesting thing, because both for that writer and for their audience, everything they did would be new, discovering new things. And so there would this period, it might be 90 minutes, but where everything they are doing it is novel before the crudescence or the Baroque period began to settle in. And that's sort of a cool thing to look forward to.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to take questions now. Gentleman at the back there.
So talking about getting smarter than human beings, you're going to build a computer, some device that makes you smarter, and then do that, make something else smarter, and that's how you get the singularity. But when we look at how we make other things, like you can't fly, but we look at birds, you can't swim very well, but we look at, you know, whales, all the sharks that can. We get to, well, we can't think very well, but what is there that we can look at that says we can think, you know, what's there to make? You know, we deal with aerodynamics by, you know, looking at how birds fly, and then what's going to be our sign to come up with how we think smart, and do we have some comparative evidence? That's the
thing. Anyone want to say
that? Sure. Let's see if I can go for it. Well, the problem with our model of intelligence right now is that it's based on ideas of formal logic and algorithmic processing that have worked extraordinarily well in the computing realm. But within the last 20 so years, people in cognitive science have been asking uncomfortable questions about what it is exactly that we do and we think. And the idea of intelligence itself as being the agency by which we are successful as a species is looking more and more questionable. There's just a heck of a lot more to do with it. And there's if you just do a Google search on embodiment, or go to Amazon, actually, and do a search on embodiment. Not that I'm suggesting anyone go to Amazon anymore. you'll find all kinds of books about what they call embodied cognition. And it's the idea that we think with our bodies. We also think with the environment around us. And what actually constitutes thought and what constitutes the mind is in a very non-metaphysical way, a non-mystical way, spreading into from the sort of inside the person to the person and the world around them as a system. And that's really cool. It gives us the opportunity to redefine and understand intelligence more and calls it to some extent into question the idea of the possibility of a limitless intelligence.
Can I add a couple of bits?
Sure.
One thing I'd like to note is artificial intelligence has been 30 years away for the past 40 years. If we learn how to do something that is within the bundle of traits labeled artificial intelligence, it stops being AI and becomes applied computer science. See also playing chess at better than grandmaster level. See also driving a car across 200 miles of desert waste without a human being behind the wheel. This was part of the core AI project 50 years ago. Where we have gotten there and done that, we're left looking at a pile of mathematical tools, and we look at it and say, but this isn't intelligence. As for the embodiment thing, I tend to think an important thing we can't leave out is language, which I refer to as the first singularity. Yes, we're embodied, we're in a feedback loop with our environment. You know, brains in bottles aren't terribly plausible. They need a body to actually provide sensory input and also output to the environment. The interesting question is language, which extends the feedback loop in parallel to other organisms. And I can't help thinking, part of what we take for intelligence is actually an emergent side effect of communication. One of the interesting things about the internet is it's a communications medium. It makes you feel somewhat smarter when you're trying to do research or work stuff out. And I'm not convinced that this is an accident.
Are you convinced it's real?
No, I'm not convinced it's real. Especially when I read things like Conservapedia articles.
Okay. I'll this gets to a question eventually. But it seems to me that the singularity raises three obvious questions. One is, what happens after? The second is, how would we get there? And the third is, what would prevent us from getting there? And what happens after is almost by definition a pointless question. And how we would get there is a mere matter of programming. And that leaves what would prevent us. And the basic arguments that I see for that are that intelligent thought in general, or at any rate, writing good software turns out to be essentially NP-hard. The question is, does that bias anything?
I don't understand that last sentence.
Does it?
NP is a computer science term.
No, the last sentence. The question is, is that a useful argument or a scenario for avoiding the singularity letting you write fiction?
I don't think it is. I think that we are an existence proof for general intelligence of a human-like kind. In much the same way that we have an existence proof for nanotechnology replicators, they're called bacteria.
Yeah.
They may not do exactly what we want them to do, but we can see them out there. And again, human intelligence, it exists. It clearly, we're fairly certain, if we take a materialist view, viewpoint is axiomatic, that it emerges from physical phenomena. Therefore, the project of trying to figure out how to do it, how to reverse engineer it from other physical mechanisms, isn't totally insane. It may, however, be very difficult. But again, we evolved in finite time. That suggests that the NP completeness isn't an actual objection.
Well, it might turn out that you can make something polynomial more intelligent.
If you've read Saturn's Children, Charlie has humanity not able to figure out how to do it on their own. So they're just copying the human brain.
Yeah, they basically figure out roughly how a human brain's neural map is laid out. So they build a computer that can do this. They put it in the head of a roughly anthropomorphic body. They switch it on, and for the first 9 months, it basically makes white noise and tries to eat its left foot. 30 years later, they've got a brain surgeon.
And then they can make 1,000 of them in the next month.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Gentlemen,
I first point out that AI is always 30 years in the future. That means it will both never come, and when it's 20 years old, it will be fusion powered. I'll pull physics on you and say that, mention that, because you're among people here, know that there are two singularities associated with classical Schwarzschild black holes. One is a real singularity at r equals zero. The other is what's called coordinate singularity at r, corresponding to the mass of the hole. And the thing is that to an infalling observer who's making no effort to try to escape, that there's no singularity there, there's no event horizon there. It's called a coordinate singularity, and I wonder, thinking back to Accelerando, that maybe total computing power isn't a good coordinate, and that there are things that it uses, and this is very vague because I'm not clever enough, but that maybe there are other coordinates that if you use them, there isn't a singularity there. And I'm thinking that maybe what we're talking about isn't so much a singularity as an event horizon or a horizon more than anything else, and those are more spread out.
Yeah, if the coordinate system you're moving in it is the same as the improvement in mental capability, then I agree with you. And in fact, I think in 1982, I had a conversation with Hans Moravec, who to me is one of the neatest, wildest guys, I mean that in an entirely admiring way, that you could ever meet. And anyway, I had been talking about the singularity. And he says, Werner, I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but if you are improving your own intelligence at the rate that you are talking about here in your talk, then there won't be any singularity. It'll be one smooth, completely intelligible ride. And he says, I intend to ride that curve.
I take the question from the gentleman.
I think that you raise the point, but it doesn't take it to the right endpoint. There's lots of different things that you can measure that have already gone through singularities. One obvious one that you tend to miss is that that if you measure the time it took for a message of some length to go between any two random people on the Earth and plot it over time, it has already gone through singularity. I mean, it can only take fractions of seconds for a message now to go from one point in time to one place on the Earth. Whereas, go back 100 years or 200 years or 400 years, that was a completely different measure. And the iPod is an example of a different singularity, the density of memory. But all those things don't affect a singularity defined in a broader sense, which is the impact of reality on everyday people's lives. And I say, so measuring any axis or any one thing, be it speed of computing, anything else, there may be singularities of many things before enough of them accumulate
to actually cause the singularity event that might be described in the broader term. So don't think of the singularity being one curve.
You're looking at the superimposition of a whole bunch of
many different technologies all going through a rapid acceleration.
Yeah.
So even then, you have singularity, the singularity, maybe more a social phenomena than anything else, because you might have a group of people living far into the singularity and the Amish at the other end. And the distribution of those people from technology ends may be more what defines society than the appearance of the technology at the far end. I'm just explaining how all the different advances might superimpose to generate the reality we see.
I think William Gibson was sort of hinting at this in the 80s when he said the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Which was a very good sort of thing for science fiction writers to play with, because we didn't have to grapple with this sort of universal singularity. We could essentially, the Amish could be our main characters. I mean, that's basically what I did in the Revelation Space books. I mean, the main characters are not the ones with the super duper high technology, they're the ones who are sort of lagging 100 years behind. And at least I was able to tell a sort of semi intelligible story in that one. I'm sorry if I'm going to take questions from this side. I apologize if I've neglected anyone else.
In terms of practical impact on human life as we know it, how does the singularity differ from, say, an encounter in 30 years' time with an alien intelligence several orders of magnitude beyond our own?
Probably doesn't, does it?
Yeah.
I think it was in the late 60s, the RAND Corporation did a study on what humanity's tactics should be if there was an alien invasion. No, it was a great foresight exercise. And they came up with one solution. Surrender. That's why I like the
Rand Corporation. It's probably a nice story to be written about a singularity happens, but it's almost indistinguishable from alien contact, or vice versa. I mean, the two things might be, because they're equally unintelligible, they might not even be distinguishable.
Well, we had a reign of cell phones in some.
There was a question from a gentleman.
There's one thing that I don't think very well explained or defined the definition of singularity, and that is comprehensibility. Events can become comprehensible to all of them. Well, depending on your population and your scale, I can describe a singularity right now. It's called programming your ECR. No one who lives more needs to be able to do it, and everyone in the right generational space can do it. So the concept of singularity, this is building on a question earlier, seems to imply that everything will be incomprehensible to all people. Is it possible to have some sort of singularity like this, but it retains partial comprehensibility, that you can go so far into this new world, but no further. I mean, is that still a singularity that we have to return, or is it just, well, there's now this range of being, and it now goes above head?
Well, the idea that frightens me the most is that the singularity arrives, and the only person who understands it is Werner.
I would say that would be good evidence that Werner should be locked away.
I've got another concern, which is the singularity arrives, and the people who are best able to deal with it are those who sort of go in for sort of magical thinking and just working on dogma handed down from ages past and invoking mystic big supernatural beings in the hope that they'll do what they want them to do, and the concept of somebody going in for imprecatory prayer as a way of relating to a vastly transcendent AI is a bit worrying.
I have a story idea around that. It involves the idea that human beings are optimized to recognize emotions and motives in other human beings. So what you do is you create essentially a human personality as an interface to natural systems or technological systems. So you create the god of electricity. You create the god of spam. The thing is that since you're relating to them in all the subtle ways that we relate to other human beings, you really get them the way that you don't get technological items. It's called The Return of the Gods. I haven't written it yet. Now it's out there and somebody else wrote it.
Take a question from the back there. By the way, I don't know when we're supposed to wrap up, but, whether it's 8 o'clock on the dot or whether we're allowed to run.
If you see strange people entering a room, you know your moments are not.
We'll keep taking questions until they kick us out.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, the back.
Is the world comprehensible now? I don't mean where you think like how, you know, that your parents figure out how to program with VR for a long time. But for example, when we think about like say a computer virus taking out the world banking system, you think about a computer virus that infects computers. The world banking system was recently taken out by a computer virus that infects people. It's called rampant speculation. That's an almost singularity-like scenario. You know, something that didn't really have the best interests of human beings at heart ate a lot of the world's money. It just vanished.
Been there, written that post-singularity scenario.
So, another exciting question I'd ask to that, does a scenario in which technology creates a world that the people living in don't understand depend upon the creation of some other entity that does understand it? Or could we just get a non-understood world?
Oh, absolutely.
I think we're already there, aren't we?
Yeah. I think for the past 400 or so years, we have been there. It's about 400 years ago, the sum total of available scholarly knowledge exceeded the capacity of any one scholar to be familiar with it all in their own lifetime.
Does any one human being understand an operating system now?
Only a very small one.
Yeah. Or a very small human being.
Very small operating system.
Take the question.
I'd like to talk about coping mechanisms. Okay, well, in the singularity, how do we understand what survival or not? And how we use language to do it. The example that I'd like to use is, we don't call them left-hand messages. We related to something we knew before, which was from the band. I'd like to ask a comment on that.
Well, I hope it's not religion. Because that's the obvious one that pops to mind.
Yeah. Could be bureaucracy.
Cats. They're inscrutable. They sometimes do what you want them to do, but not always. But occasionally they bite you or take a piss on the car.
I'm aware that there are four men here, and all the questions we've had so far have been from men. Do you have any women with any questions or us?
Yes.
Sure. After the singularity, do you have any stuff tips? Hey, I'm over 50, I'm starting to worry about retirement, and if it happens sooner rather than later, I want to remember nothing.
Actually, I went to a talk on that, and the guy's I didn't agree with his conclusions, but his conclusion was roughly that if the idea became very widespread, if believability became very high, that it was imminent, that you would see some very strange things, like people would be selling their retirement policies and trying to find the sucker who would buy their retirement policy. Because they know that after the singularity, their dollars won't mean anything. I'll tell you, if it were me in that situation, I'd be going around buying all these retirement houses. There's always a chance.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a bet you can't lose.
Yeah.
We probably.
So, why are we answering this by saying language is the first singularity? But there are multiple levels of singularity, right? We're sort of on a flat intellectual plateau now. then we ramp up, we get to another plateau, or does it just keep going upwards?
Oh, I think there are beyond. I have a little missed. And going backwards, too.
Yeah, Robert K. Logan has a book called The Extended Mind, which covers some of those ideas.
Would everyone just like just one sort of wrapping up statement? Bernard, you have?
No.
Suitably 15.
Great, okay.
I'll do. Charlie?
Just from the point of view of writing science fiction, having written my big Singularity book, I'm now trying to ignore it. Because, you know, it seems to me there's an awful lot of interesting stuff to do around the edges still.
Yeah, and I've worked on a fully developed alternative piece of megalomania called The Rewilding. I gave a talk on it at OSCON last summer, and you can find some hints of that on YouTube if you look me up. I have absolutely everything I need to write that novel except the plot. So,
thank you, everyone. Thanks.